Do you know when you're in the pub and an old football match comes on, a rocket of a shot hits the bar and bounces out? And then somebody says, do you ever wonder what would have happened if that had gone in? Imagine if we'd scored that. What if we'd won that game?
Then everyone has an opinion. Well, the manager would probably have kept his job. We could have gone in to win the league that year. Ah, we still would have messed it up. We were shite anyway. Such fine margins that could have potentially massive consequences.
In this series, we look at some of the biggest what-ifs in football history. What happened? What could easily have played out very differently? And what we think might have happened instead? This is Outside the Box.
The 1988 UEFA European Championship Final.
And here's Robins. And did it get the deflection? Was it Robins or Pierce?
Attention. Attention, Kostadinov.
What? Oh,
Yes. No, linesman says no. The linesman says no.
I think they should really stop flogging a dead horse, basically. It's over. It's finished.
You can't be wrong when something's good. It's never gone. Love's got the world in motion.
This week, what if David Platt hadn't scored and Belgium had knocked England out in the last 16 of Italian 90? Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Outside the Box, the Football What If podcast. I am Gerard O'Shea and joining me as ever is my co-host Dave Fleming.
Hello, thank you very much. It's great to be here as always. Now on this episode, we had some very slight technical difficulties and the Zoom quality at times dropped out a little bit, but we've done our best to tidy it up. So bear with us. We think it still sounds pretty good. England came into the World Cup in Italy in 1990 on the back of a dismal decade for football in the country. The national team had failed to make an impact at any of the international tournaments in the 80s, and while English clubs had dominated European competitions in the early part of the decade, they had spent the previous 5 years banned from Europe following the Heysel tragedy in 1985.
The spectre of fan trouble loomed large over English clubs and the national side, to the extent that the UK government in 1989 seriously considered withdrawing the country from the World Cup. Manager Bobby Robson was due to leave the job after the tournament, and hopes weren't particularly high as the team headed for Italy.
Allegedly to minimise the hooligan risk, England were banished by the authorities off the Italian mainland for the group stages, exiled in Sardinia and Sicily. They topped a pretty boring group in uninspiring fashion, scoring just twice, to set up a second round tie with the semi-finalists from 1986, Belgium. With the game just 1 minute away from heading to a penalty shootout, David Platt volleyed home what is still the latest winning goal in World Cup history.
England went on to secure a dramatic, if perhaps slightly fortunate, victory over Cameroon in a thrilling quarterfinal, to set up a semi-final with West Germany in Turin. Over 25 million people in Britain watched the match, which saw England play their best game of the tournament, saw Gaza reduced to tears, and later, the same fate befall Stuart Pearce and Chris Waddle as England fell agonisingly short, losing on penalties to the eventual winners.
More than 300,000 people thronged the streets of Luton to welcome home the team in a party reminiscent of the VE Day celebrations. England had fallen in love with the national team again. They had a new hero in Paul Gascoigne, and the bright lights of the Premier League, trademark greatest league in the world, were less than 2 years away, while English clubs were readmitted to European competition. The doom and gloom around English football seemed to be lifting. But what if Platt hadn't scored and Belgium had knocked England out in the second round?
Joining us to discuss how different English football might have looked is Mark Godfrey, the founder of the Football Pink fanzine and website, the man behind such podcasts as What Happened to You, The Drop, the Brian McClare podcast Life with Brian, and the wonderful Vincere 90. Something of a love song to this, the most iconic of all football tournaments. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, guys. Thank you for inviting me.
I suppose to kick off from an Irish perspective, we're very familiar with why Italia 90 was so special, getting to the quarterfinals in our first ever World Cup and all that. But what is it about the tournament that makes it so special for England? Is it simply getting to the semi-finals, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's a lot more to it. And although the reasons for it being important might not be exactly the same as why Italia 90 was important to Ireland and the Irish people, particularly of a certain age, let's say. But I think it's more to do with what the impact the tournament had upon English society that is in orbit of the football. In a way, the football is almost secondary to what happened around the tournament and subsequently, and what that means to everybody. It's, I think the best way to put it is, I find that Italia 90 is a cultural touchstone. You've got similar instances in for Euro 96, for example. Again, football necessarily isn't what everybody remembers. It's three lions, and you can mention other ones since then and probably before, but the impact goes far beyond actually just getting to the semi-finals of a football tournament.
Just for the background to the football for a sec, like English football, as we said in the intro, was in a pretty bad place. The performance in Euro 88 was pretty dire, and the press treatment of Bobby Robson in particular and the team in general was kind of atrocious in the lead up to the tournament. So as a big football fan at the time, like what was that atmosphere like before the tournament actually even kicked off?
Well, you've mentioned a lot of the points already in your introduction, and of course here is you have to sort of rewind and this gradual descent into, I don't know what you would call it, hell almost for English football through hooliganism at European Championships in 1980, where I think it was against Belgium, police tear gassed the English crowd, the English supporters who were there. And then you've got poor performances at Spain 82, not even qualifying for the European Championships in 84. Obviously, Maradona knocked England out in 86, but I mean, England were a great side. Euro 88 was terrible. Of course, losing to Ireland as well. And the English national team was, we were qualifying really well for tournaments, but once we got there, we weren't really lighting the place up. So I think in 1990, people had lost faith in the England team. They'd certainly lost faith in Bobby Robson, which was an agenda totally driven by the press. His leaving the England job after Italia 90 was leaked, of course, before the World Cup. So the papers had kind of got what they wanted, but they were really burying the knife as deep as they could in the build-up to the tournament. They were harassing him for his private life. They were calling him this, that, and the other. And everything really was at a low point. And you set that against the backdrop of, as I said, a whole decade's worth of hooliganism, falling attendances. I mean, my first game as a supporter was when I was about 4.5 back in 1981 and going to football regularly, dragged along by my dad. I don't know how we got that one past my mum, on a weekly basis. And the threat of hooliganism and the reality of hooliganism and what effect that had on what was going on in the stadium, but also on the pitch, because a lot of English football was dire in the 80s. You know, the whole thing, it was a reality. It wasn't just this spectre that, you know, the bogeyman. It was a thing that happened. Fights in and around grounds was something you saw all the time. And then, of course, you've got the three big events of English football. The Bradford Fire, which really highlighted the state of the majority of English football stadia at that time. You know, these things were all built back in the Edwardian or even Victorian times. And, you know, something like that would probably never happen today because, you know, the facilities that people watch football in are just so much better prepared for any eventuality. You've got, of course, the Heysel disaster, which meant English clubs being banned from Europe for 5 years. And that kind of made us look at ourselves from that perspective. And certainly while we were out of Europe on the club scene, which we dominated for the previous decade, it sort of made us look at, you know, what had our football become on the pitch. And the one that really probably is the defining moment in everything to do with English football, of course, is Hillsborough and what happened there. And then everything really started beginning to change from that point, how we played football, how we viewed football, how we consumed football, how we watched football. Everybody realised that everything had to change, not just one thing here and there, not just the stadium, not just what happened on the field or the television. And Hillsborough was an absolute shock to the core. And Italia 90 we were still in that sort of daze, really, I think, over what happened at Hillsborough. And basically this long drawn out trauma, really, of the 1980s. And I think Italia 90 becomes this moment of redemption, if you like, that sets us on a different path.
Yeah, did it feel like something beforehand that could matter positively or negatively.
We were in a tough group with Ireland, who you know, you'd beaten us in Euro 88, Holland, who'd stuffed us in Euro 88 and were the champions, and Egypt were no mugs. So supporters never really had any expectations for England, Italia 90. So anything people were considering in the wake of the World Cup was certainly unspoken. I think it was a very short-term view. We were still in, as I said, that post-Hillsborough days, I think, football in general, and maybe even the country in general. Where were we going? What were we doing? If you take a look at wider society, you know, Thatcher's time was on its last legs. We'd had the poll tax and various other things. We're really having a say on how people felt in modern society. And I think that the football element of it very much couldn't look past the end of its nose and what had happened. I think Italia 90 gave us a break from that and showed us what could be possible. And then, of course, there's lots of other things that then inform what happens to England in the following years as a country, not just in terms of its in terms of its football.
So if I say to you, England at Italia 90, is there an image that immediately comes to your mind?
Well, the obvious one is Paul Gascoigne in tears at the semi-final. I mean, there are many, but that's the most obvious one. Gaz is crying in the semi-final.
To kind of get to brass tacks straight away, and we're talking here, if England had gone out to Belgium, how much of those iconic images, you know, there's the Gaza tears, there's probably their, you know, whatever other ones you care to think about. If you don't have those, does Italia 90 have that redemptive moment? We can obviously discuss this in a good bit more detail, but does Italia 90 even resonate as a competition without those images in the English psyche?
I think it does, but nowhere near to the same extent, because any tournament where you as the viewer and your team does well, of course, has a huge impact. But I think even if England had gone out in the second round to Belgium, you still have the fact that it's probably, well, I think it is the first World Cup where for us here on our time zone, we get to see 2-3 games a day at times that are convenient. So it was round-the-clock coverage, which we didn't have before that. I think that element of it would have given us maybe something, but certainly England doing well was 90 to 95% of the success of the whole tournament and how it sort of still is viewed here, despite it being a poor tournament in terms of football.
It is a poor tournament in football terms.
There's Stephen Scragg in the These Football Times. I was looking up this earlier on. He has an article that just is titled "Italia 90 was not as good as you think." But yeah, I think it's definitely for Irish fans. It's when we look back on it, we look at the quality of football that we played and we were involved in, and a lot of the football was quite dour. But it was about much more than that. It was about the journey and actually winning something and a positive football story for once. And it seems to be, even you are involved in probably the best game in the tournament, the quarterfinal against Cameroon. It was the only game where both teams scored at least twice, I think. And it was, I've gone back and watched the highlights. It looked like an absolute belter. But like you've kind of been saying from the start, Mark, it seems to be more an overarching kind of cultural positivity rather than being about the specific football. Because you had a good performance against the Dutch in the group stage, but otherwise the Ireland game and the Egypt game were both pretty dour as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The England-Ireland game, there was a newspaper headline the day after the game and, you know, lumping the Irish in with the English at the time. It said, "No football, please, we're British." And that sort of summed it up, really. You know, it was only 2 points for a win. So nobody was willing to risk it so much. But yeah, I think an hour of the Holland game, England played well. The Egypt game was pretty poor. The Belgium game was good, from a point of view, is it could have gone either way. The Cameroon game was a classic. Again, could have gone either way. Cameroon could have won and England wouldn't have had any really reason to complain. And for me, actually, the best game of the tournament was the West Germany semi-final, even though we won lost.
They lead 4-3, and that means that England have to score the next one to stay in it. Would you want to be Chris Waddle now? Germany are through to the final on penalty kicks.
But I suppose, yeah, from an Irish perspective, part of, I think, what Italia 90 in a cultural sense represents, I think, is sort of our arrival as a country on the world stage, and a sense that, you know, we belong up there with all of the other countries by ourselves. We are able to go out and have a place in the world. And it probably does. I mean, people will debate this and will under or overstate it. it probably has a big impact on our economics of the 90s, certainly in terms of our attitude and our confidence as a nation. And I suspect there's something similar going on with England, but it's maybe a slightly different, because probably there hasn't been that lack of confidence in terms of on the world stage, but there's certainly a different England that emerges in the 90s as a result.
Yeah, and you know, I'm very much interested in the impact that the whole tournament had upon Ireland. But I think it's very much in a different way, isn't it? And again, this is for, you know, I don't want to condescend in or anything here by any means, yeah. But you know, the perception of Ireland, let's say before 1990, was very much this rural, old-fashioned country, quite religious, conservative. And then in the 90s, of course, you get the Celtic Tiger. You know, Ireland is no longer seen as this place where people emigrated from, but it was a destination. People came to Ireland, whether that be on holiday or, you know, from the European Union to work. People were more affluent. It was suddenly becoming a modern 21st century country. Whereas in England, it's a different change that you start seeing. And I think it's all of a sudden acid house and the Manchester music scene and all of that kind of stuff, allied with, you know, Thatcher disappearing, would take more of a role in the European Union, it feels, around that time. Society seems to become more relaxed. You know, the Cold War's ending. All that sort of stuff has a part to play, and Italian 90s dropped right into the middle of that.
And chipped in, and volleyed in, and it's there by David Platt! England have done it in the last minute of extra time! England are through to the quarterfinals of the World Cup, and Bobby Robson,
World in Motion, the football, the song, the England song for the World Cup in Italia 90, maybe apart from Three Lions, the only good football song ever. But it's not just a good football song, it's a great song. Like, did that help open the doors for that kind of a cultural movement in the 90s?
It did, absolutely. Of course, you guys had Put Them Under Pressure, didn't you, to go with the 1990 World Cup. So, you had that, whereas we had like a catalogue World Cup songs going back 20 or 30 years that were just awful. You know, the team would, you know, go to a recording studio in their knitwear and they would all sing, have a sort of a terrace sing-along sort of song. And it was all way too cheesy and, you know. But then we got to 1919, here's New Order, and then they get John Barnes to do a rap. I mean, and as you say, the song is actually, it stands alone if you just pay no attention to what the lyrics mean. It's a standalone, very good song. And that was kind of a moment that the beginning of the tournament, I seem to remember, because I bought it on single, and thinking, yeah, this is cool. Football's cool again. I think in one of the episodes of In Gerard, I talked with this about David Goldblatt, who's very much into the culture around English football and written many good books about football in general. And he doesn't agree with me so much that Italia 90 had that big an impact on English football and the change. It was actually slightly before all of that. And World in Motion is just one little facet of all of this.
I would probably share your view rather than David Goldblatt's on that. I think Italia 90 is a massive thing. It's not the only one, clearly. Some of the music scene has obviously started already. And as you discussed, we've had the likes of Hillsborough have had that sort of both introspection, but also physical infrastructure that needs to change around the game. But I do think if you take Italia 90 out, or in the context of what we're discussing here, if you take out the latter three rounds of the tournament, which is effectively probably, you know, largely how it would have been certainly remembered from an English team perspective, it's a moment that opens out these to a bigger audience. And it, you know, and we've obviously got Nessun Dorma on the BBC, which is a whole other angle on music. But it's something that I think bleeds through right into the 90s, because you get Cool Britannia, you get Britpop, which tend to draw on football and football draws on it. You get New Labour come in, which is probably not coincidentally just after Euro 96, with a very football overtones in that. And I don't think any of that happens if you haven't had this moment in Italia 90 of on national TV screens with 25 million people watching that confluence of culture, of football, of music. I think if you take Italia 90 out of it, yes, it may still happen, but does it happen to the same extent? I think you take Italia 90 out, you do certainly lose something.
I agree with you, because what the genesis of the Premier League sort of came before Italia 90. So the Big Five, as they were called then, were chatting about it, and it was very much something that was on the cards anyway. But I think Italia 90, the success, the televisual success of Italia 90 was the light bulb moment for the television executives and the chairman of these big clubs to say this was the green light. It was like, look at the possibilities, look at Gazzamania and how you can be on the front page for good reasons, not just what had gone before. And, you know, what is the potential for us to exploit that? And it's no coincidence, again, that Sky transmit, what is it, a year later or something, yeah. Or maybe not even a year later, they first go on air. I think what then happened in terms of Sky and the Premier League in 1992 does not happen to the same extent as it did. Had England not done what they'd done and seen how football could be projected to an audience. So it's not just because ITV had took up a lot of the English football in the immediate aftermath of Italia 90, but they were like, they would introduce the show, play the game, obviously with the pundit there doing a few comments alongside the commentator. And then basically as soon as the game ended, they were off air. But then you add in the musical element of it, how to show the game and the highlights and the narratives, the context around each game. And then, of course, introducing analysis of what's gone on. That all started coming in at Italia 90. And that laid down a bit of a template then. I don't think what's subsequently gone on in the next 30 years is possible without it. And it's a ripple effect. Germany and Italy and all these other countries probably didn't have as big a problem to deal with as England, in terms of especially Italy, who had the best league in the world at the time. Yep. But they've all taken their cue from English football.
There's a huge point there, Mark, that it's like live football was barely on TV before Italia 90. There's some FA Cup ties, the FA Cup final, and maybe mm-hmm. general cup finals were televised, right? But apart from match of the day, mm-hmm. there was no or very rarely live league football on. And then suddenly in 1992, you've got live league football behind a paywall, and that people are willing to suddenly pay this subscription to Sky to watch league football. The massive capturing of the public imagination that with England's like great performances and emotional moments that happen, particularly after the Belgium game, drive that in a massive, massive way. That only 2 years later, suddenly league football, people are willing to prop up a company like Sky and pay for live league football.
Yeah, I suspect that maybe you saw more live English football on the television than we did at that time. Yeah, I think Simon Hart, who was one of the guys, brilliant guy, who wrote the book World in Motion about Italia 90. He quotes in his book something like there was only sort of six or seven live games, something on, FA Cup ties, the FA Cup final, and absolutely no European football on television. Yeah. Of course, English clubs were banned, but we didn't even see the European Cup final or anything like that on television in England in the season immediately before Italia 90. So immediately after the World Cup, Sky saw what was possible and absolutely dedicated to themselves to revolutionising how we consumed football, not just how we watched football.
So are we sort of saying, though, because a lot of these have been set in train, if Italia 90 had been a shorter tournament for England, a lot of this may have happened anyway, but potentially the level of money may not have been there. So Sky may have still been broadcasting the Premier League and there may have still been a paywall, but the number of people and how much they've been willing to pay would have been less. Is that kind of what we think might have happened instead?
I think it was going to come because, well, it's BSkyB, was it, or BSB before that. They, as you said, they'd already set themselves in motion. It's very much, I'm not sure. I'll be honest, yeah. I'm not sure.
The FA Premier League, live, only on Sky. It's a whole new
I think there's a period sort of from Hillsborough probably to 1992 where, I know you've touched on Hillsborough, in the middle of that we've also got Italia 90, we've got the start of the Premier League, we've got the start of the Champions League, and we've got the back pass rule. But I actually think within that little period we see probably more change. Like, I think the football from now, the money is obviously much bigger, but the game now back to 1993 or 94, I think is much more similar than the game was from 93 to 88. I think there's just all of these things change on and off the field. And it's very hard, I think, to separate, well, if you take out Italia 90 or if you take out the foundation of the Premier League on their own. I think in that sort of 89 to 92 period, I think is the single biggest period of change.
I agree. And, you know, the back pass rule comes in pretty much directly as a consequence of Italia 90. I know it didn't actually start until after the European Championship final in 92. But, I mean, you only have to look back at the successful Liverpool side of the 80s. You know, just, you know, they go 1-0 up and then spend 20 minutes just passing it back to Bruce Grobbelaar all the time. You know, nobody wanted to watch that. Italia 90 had its faults, but without it, the game didn't get better.
These things were happening in football a lot, but without the widespread TV coverage of Italia 90 and then the TV coverage to come, the real change wouldn't have happened. The real change was made for a TV perspective rather than a footballing perspective, I think.
Gary and Alan, like the rest of us, looking forward to a new season with a new league. There are new rules, passed back at your peril.
Talking here about the English fans' kind of national psyche, which is something that as outsiders always found very, very interesting. And I must admit, as a small-minded Irish fan, sometimes enjoyable to watch. But one thing I do want to talk about is something, if David Platt doesn't score that goal, what doesn't happen is that England's first ever penalty shootout happens against West Germany in the semi-final of the World Cup. It's an enormous deal. You've played really well, like you said, the best you've probably played in years. Both teams could have won, and I do completely agree with you that if England had won that game, they would have beaten Argentina in the final and won the World Cup. You lost the penalty shootout, and that becomes such a big deal for English teams. The sense of gloom and pessimism over English teams in penalty shootouts. The last right up until the World Cup just gone, when you beat Colombia on a penalty shootout. But if that doesn't happen, and maybe you get beaten by Belgium in a less dramatic round on a penalty shootout in the round of 16, or maybe you beat Belgium on a penalty shootout in your first ever penalty shootout in the round of 16, what difference do you think maybe that might have had on England's performances in later tournaments?
Well, that Germany, the loss to West Germany in the semi-final, it's a scar that's probably never healed, or a wound, that's never healed. But I think, yes, it was, I think, a temporary feeling of doom for that particular one. I think the one that really cut deeper was the loss in 96, because we'd had the previous experience of going through that, but it was the first time, again, that we had this glow after Italia 90 where, you know, we never expected to do well. So to just to lose out to the, you know, the best team in the competition, there was a weird pride in that, I suppose. The one that affects us more, I think, is the Euro 96 defeat. But when you combine them together, yeah, that's, I still don't think beating Colombia in Russia, everybody said at last we've won one and, you know, we can consign those other ones to the bin. But no, I mean, you know, we still talk about it. We still feel it. We still, you know, if we go to the next tournament, we end up in a penalty shootout, we're not going to remember Colombia. We're going to think about Southgate. We're going to think about Chris Waddle. We're going to think about Stuart Pearce. You know, we've been deeply affected by these incidences. And I don't, not in my lifetime, I don't think that's ever going to change.
I'm sorry for bringing that up. It's obviously quite a...
Last month, England achieved its traditional 0-0 draw in their World Cup qualifying game against Sweden in Stockholm, but it was events off the field which made the headlines. It was the same awful story all over again, horribly behaved football hooligans dragging the Union Jack through the mud.
Chief Superintendent Kurt Nielsen said in a broadcast, "It is not safe to be on the streets because of the English. When these people get going, there is always trouble and chaos."
One of the other things that happens out of it, and we've talked a bit about Heysel and that sort of stuff and how the ban coming to an end, but the bad reputation that England fans have, they're not alone, but they're probably they're bottom of that table, I suppose, leading up to the tournament and getting sent off to Sardinia and Sicily. By the end of the competition, English fans have gone through 7 games in Italy, 4 of those on the mainland and little serious trouble. But if England had gone home after 1 game on the mainland, would they have ever had that chance? You know, how important were those extra games in Turin and right through to the third, fourth place playoff in restoring the reputation of supporters? I mean, would the ban have ended if Italia 90 hadn't gone as well as it had from a fan perspective?
Well, I think there were murmurings before the tournament that UEFA were considering ending the ban. And Italia 90, in a way, was kind of like an exam that English fans had to pass. And actually, I would slightly disagree with what you said about there being very little trouble, because there was the famous, what was it, the Battle of Rimini, I think it was.
With the mass arrests.
I think it was, yeah, when they deported exactly the same amount of people that there was for a 737 back to England.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of seats on the plane to send them back. So there was a famous Battle of Rimini ahead of the Belgium game, I think it was. The semi-final as well, apparently, was a bit of a war zone. Okay. There was a lot of Italian fans looking for retribution for Heist after the game. But before the game too, England fans didn't have a particularly great experience. So there were several incidences. Mm. I think a lot of that was kind of glossed over when UEFA came to making the decision to readmit English clubs. But I think that had more to do with the England's performance on the pitch than it did with the supporters. But I think the Italian police and the authorities, by limiting the amount of English they could get into Sardinia first and then onto the mainland, I think they probably felt they'd done a good enough job to suppress wide-scale violence and disruption that could have been caused. So it by no means did it go off without a hitch, but I think the England team's performance perhaps helped to sort of, as I say, gloss over that.
I remember listening to Vincere, your podcast, the one about the West Germany game. It sounds like for a lot of the tournament, English fans were kind of on the receiving end of often police-led violence, wasn't it? I can't remember what the name of the guest was on that episode. He said that he arrived after a horrible detour, a train from Naples via Rome into Turin, and then instantly they were all just pretty much arrested and moved to a camp on the outskirts of the town. It doesn't sound like it was, like, again, like you say, a lot of it was glossed over. It doesn't sound like it was a terribly pleasant experience for fans on the mainland.
No, not at all. It would have been Pete Davis, yeah, whose book All Played Out really is one of the great football books. He sort of had this one foot in the England camp and one foot, you know, travelling with the fans and doing reporting for various newspapers at the time. So he saw firsthand what English fans experienced. And also I spoke to Kevin Allen, his video diary called On the March with Bobby's Army. You get to see the conditions that English football fans were exposed to and the, you know, the police treatment they experienced the whole time they were there. And it isn't pretty at all. It's awful. It's absolutely terrible. But that was the standard. And, you know, you hear a lot even these days about how Italian police or Spanish police handle English fans, you know, if they're just standing watching the game or they're having a beer in a piazza or whatever outside. And yes, there can be pockets of troublemakers, as there are at any point, but it seems to be a standard practice for Italian police to take an aggressive stance towards English football fans. And it was probably turbocharged in 1990. So I think it was deliberately made that way to try and discourage, you know, 50,000 England fans showing up, you know, and going on the rampage through various Italian cities.
It probably wasn't unique to the Italians. I mean, being a football fan, again, I was too young and obviously not in England at the time, but that was how football fans were viewed, as trouble to be policed and corralled rather than people who were there to enjoy an event, to experience an event, to watch sport. And that's clearly something that changes, you know, with Hillsborough and the All-Seater Stadium and everything that comes along afterwards. But certainly football fans were seen as something to be policed because they were a danger to themselves and others rather than needed to be protected.
Irish fans went en masse to Italy, and to all intents and I don't want to necessarily lump you in with English folk, but I think a lot of continental people perhaps believe that English and Irish people are very similar. You know, we speak the same language and there's a historical relationship between the two. Yet there was, and maybe this is because there was no history, or there was a very brief history of Irish football fans going to major soccer events with, you know, as far as I'm aware, no great problems in Euro 88. But because the Irish didn't have this long and terrible history behind them, that they were treated really well. The Scots too. And again,
you know, the Scots are probably lumped in with the English fans quite a lot, I would imagine, in Europeans' perceptions. Yet the treatment was you know, polar opposite.
I think probably from an Irish fan's point of view, one of our previous pods, we talked about Ireland at Euro 88, and we had a guest on, Dermot Bulger, who's a playwright who was at the second two group games in Germany. And it kind of seemed to be the case that, again, if English fans kind of go with an expectation, like you say, there was a familiarity with English fans at foreign venues, but it was the first time Irish fans were there, and they were just so happy to be there that they were just kind of wanted to be friends with everyone and have a bit of crack. But I imagine there was absolutely examples of very similar behaviour from both sets of fans that was treated very, very differently by police. I'm not sure why.
Yeah. And, you know, the English fan base, it's very representative of a certain the Brits on the piss kind of mentality, yeah, with a lot of folk who follow England abroad. Again, I don't want to tar everybody with that brush whatsoever, but it's a perception, and it can only be a perception if there's some degree of truth in it. We've all been to Spanish holiday resorts and seen groups of English lads when they get drunk and a bit leery and a bit rowdy, and how that can go, whether it's ever meant to go that way. You know how that can play out. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that with a group of Irish lads. If I've been in Ireland and I've been out, never gone that way. Or if I've seen some Irish people on holiday, I've never seen that happen with Irish people, maybe not with Scottish people. There's just something about English people in that environment.
Yeah, it's probably true. I mean, it's certainly, I've seen Irish people out on the piss not behaving particularly well. But I certainly think when we go abroad, we've had a thing about defining ourselves as not being English.
Yeah.
And very much doing, well, if the English do this, we have to do the opposite. Partly because people will see us the same. So, you know, and we've become a bit of a pastiche of ourselves, like at the Euros in 2016, where we had, you know, there was competitive outdoing. How nice could we be at helping nuns cross the road and helping kids go to school and that kind of stuff?
One of the, when we focus specifically on Ireland, on one of our episodes in the show, we had Paul Doyle, The Guardian, yeah, and Jonathan O'Brien on, and they both said exactly the same thing. You know, that you guys went out of your way to be absolutely not English, to the point where you kind of become, as you say, a pastiche or a parody of yourself almost, as these guys who are coming for a great crack and all of that kind of stuff. Maybe the one big difference between you and us is that we have this centuries-old ingrained mentality of being the conqueror. And maybe that informs the way we behave in these sorts of situations that is not, of course, doesn't happen with you guys.
We've effectively touched on this in so many areas already, but in your view, how would Italia 90 be remembered had England gone out unremarkably in the last 16? So not, you know, you've not gone out to a complete minnow getting beaten off the pitch 4-5-0, but you've not gone out in the semi-finals on penalties to the winners. An unremarkable quarter-final, last 16 on penalties defeat, how would Italia 90 be remembered?
I think you have to take it out of the context that we've discussed about the time and the Premier League and Hillsborough and all of that stuff. If we take it out of that context and just simply examine it as a football tournament, I think it'll be barely remembered is what I think. But that's simply looking at it without putting anything else around it that we've already talked about.
Here's a footballing what if of what would have happened. Belgium beat England. How would Belgium and Cameroon have gone? Could Cameroon have gone to the semi-final? Cameroon are really... They talk about patronising teams, like there's like, they had a really good go of it, but England kind of got over the line in the end. That was a brilliant Cameroon team. And they performed excellently, if a little naively towards the end, giving away those two penalties. But how do we think Belgium would have got on against Cameroon?
You know what, I think it's a toss of the coin, because I think England and Belgium were very evenly matched. Good sides with a couple of world-class players in. You know, we had Gascoigne and Lineker, let's say. Well, Belgium had the same. They had Koelemans, who had been around a long time, very experienced, very, very good player. And they had Enzo Schifo in midfield, who was kind of their young midfield star. Not the same sort of character as Gascoigne, but certainly as influential. So they were a good side. But again, they probably weren't used to, as England weren't, they probably weren't used to facing anything quite like Cameroon. Because Cameroon, if you watch that Cameroon game back, they were relentless, coming at England and coming and coming and coming. And it was only really the latter part, well, do you know what, not even the latter part of extra time, because I think they had a couple of chances to take it to penalties as well. But Belgium probably had never seen a side, or very rarely seen a side like Cameroon before. Whether they would have had the fortitude to repel them as England did in the end.
They went ahead against Argentina, Romania and Colombia, and none of those teams managed to come back. England did, yeah. So I'm not sure that, we've seen that it was an excellent English team. I'm not sure Belgium would have been able to survive that onslaught.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And again, we often say that one of the things that about England players is that they're usually fitter than most, or maybe that's what we thought at the time, because they ran more. So maybe the Belgian side wouldn't have recuperated and being in prime condition to face the Cameroon team after playing England and going to extra time, let's say. Maybe they would have been, you know, less prepared for it, and Cameroon would have beaten them solely on being in fitter and stronger. It's hard to say, but there's some discussion that all wasn't well in the Cameroon camp. I know we think that they were all a happy bunch and this was the time of their lives and so on. And I'm sure it was for the majority of them, but they had a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. And there's some thought that some of the team that actually played against England they wanted to go home by that point. So they would have felt the same had they played Belgium. So that lack of conviction to actually do the job, you know, they were on the verge of the semi-final and probably should have beaten England, but their heart wasn't in it for some of them. And maybe that would have been the same against Belgium.
And it's going to be Andy Bremer, perhaps the most important one of all. It's Bremer for West Germany with the penalty.
I think West Germany were the best team in it, but again, there's an argument to say that they peaked in the beginning, you know, from absolutely blitzing an extremely good Yugoslavia team in the first game and struggling to put away a terrible Argentina in the final. You know, they peaked very, very early and struggled to maintain that. Whereas, you know, Belgium had a decent group stage. You know, had they beaten England, beaten England, then gone on to defeat Cameroon, who, you know, were one of the best two or three sides in it, who knows, they might have actually taken West Germany out in the semis.
I kind of just, somebody else whose reputation was restored or by this run to the semi-final and this excellent performance was one of the good guys in English football, I think, anyway, looking from the outside, was Bobby Robson, who went from a figure of tabloid hatred and vitriol before the tournament. You touched on it earlier, Mark, that they spent about 6 years telling him to leave. And then when he finally said, all right, well, the FA are not renewing my contract, so I'm going. And then they leaked the story and eviscerate him for that as well. He's now almost seen as a saintly figure in English life.
Yeah, terrible behaviour. But what do you expect from the English media there? You know, especially of that era as well. They absolutely crucified him. And then, you know, up until Italia 90, then a few weeks later, as you say, he's venerated. You know, he's this saint who could do no wrong, and he never changed. I think he was the same person throughout that whole period. You know, you got to, what was it, 8 years of that being treated as he was, and then it came to a crescendo at Italia 90, and you know the players wouldn't speak to the media based upon their treatment of Bobby Robson, and they all loved Bobby Robson. Okay, he would. You know, there are the stories about him getting their names and, you know, they used to take the mickey out of him and one thing and another, but they genuinely loved him. The English public's opinion of him, I think, very much doesn't mirror the media's, because I don't think the English public ever hated Robson. Because of how England were reported on by the media, they felt like, especially from Euro 88 onwards, they felt like they needed to change the manager, and it's only in subsequent years that people appreciate more how good a manager he was. First of all, you know, they won the UEFA Cup with Ipswich. They nearly won the league once or twice under him. And then everything he did with Porto and Sporting and Barcelona, and then, of course, came back to Newcastle. So Italian 90 was a huge redemptive experience for him. Off the back of, you know, one terrible tournament and one where he got knocked out by a wonder goal and the most obvious, the most famous handball in football history. You know, how are you supposed to deal with that? But he's a central. I don't think he is a central figure. I think he's often a slightly too peripheral figure when we look back at England at Italian 90. I don't think he often gets the credit he deserves, because remember he was very much a man, a 4-4-2 man, and he had his preconceptions of how England should play, and a lot of England's best players didn't actually play that well in that system. John Barnes hated 4-4-2. Chris Waddle wasn't a huge fan, but he realised after consulting the players as well after that Ireland game that something needed to change if England were actually going to do well at this tournament. And I think it was the Holland game, you know, against the European champions, Van Basten, Hullit, Rijkaard, all the rest of them, that they went to that 5-3-2 situation that, other than the game against Egypt, I think, they then stuck with for the rest of the tournament. And actually, you know, you look at that, England's best performances were all, you know, off the hoof, if you like.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about how he's more peripheral than he should be, that it's taken us till now to mention him. Oh, and by the way, what about Bobby Robson? So it's sort of, it is interesting how he's been. Dave, you had one other just interesting question that when we were chatting about this, it's not directly football related, but Gaza crying and Pierce crying and all that sort of stuff. How much of that influenced what went on in the UK later in the 90s? It becomes a very emotional decade with you know, Thatcher obviously at the end of 90 and Princess Diana. You know, did the lads crying in Turin, did they make it okay to cry?
Yeah, I'd never seen a man cry on television before, I don't think. I'd certainly never seen a footballer cry, other than my own, you know, when you're in the playground and somebody, yeah, you know, gets beat or whatever. But that's the only time I've ever seen a male cry at a football game. I'd never seen it. And then all of a sudden, there he is. And, you know, thinking about how macho culture would have been back then, nobody, there was never really the sense of like, oh, you're the big Jesse, you know, pull yourself together, any of that stuff. He won the nation over, you know, not just women who felt sorry for him, but men who could understand the emotion that he was going through. And I think there was an appreciation of how immature Paul Gascoigne was. He was a big kid, still is a big kid, I think. But he was a big kid, and everybody projected themselves into him and thinking how he must have felt at that moment, realizing, oh, if we get to the World Cup final, I'm not going to play, you know, understanding the emotional character that he was. But it certainly did make it more acceptable to cry, to the point where 30 years later, well, none of us bat an eyelid if we see a player crying on the field now. But even probably within a year or two, if you saw it again, there was never this macho reaction of, you know, pull yourself together or what a wimp crying on the field. It was just one of these things that suddenly we started becoming more empathic towards these people who, let's face it, you know, they've put in a lot and sacrificed a lot to get to the place they are in their sport. Most of us don't realize what they go through to get to that position. It then ramps up again to an entirely different level with Princess Diana. And this country has never been the same again, in my view, since the fallout from what happened there. Sometimes I think, you know, we perhaps should have pulled ourselves together a bit sooner after that, because I don't think we've necessarily, you know, the way we behave and react to events these days has changed a lot since then. But certainly, to, you know, to use an appropriate phrase, the floodgates opened after Gascoigne's tears.
So involved in this game, he has actually, Gascoigne, got a yellow card. And oh dear me, he's going to be out of the final if England get there. For the tackle on number 14, Berthold, Gascoigne has had his second yellow card of the competition, and here is a moment that almost brings tears to his eyes.
We've never gone, what if it had happened? This is the sequence of things, because I think it's too wide-ranging. I think there's too many potential implications on and off the field. But it sort of seems like we think a lot of the social change, a lot of the football change, a lot of the social change around football had begun would have continued in train, potentially being moderated because it was part of a wider movement, probably Germany would have won the World Cup anyway. So actually, a lot of stuff might have still happened the same, just maybe at a different pace or in a slightly different way, if England had gone out to Belgium in the last 16.
Yeah, I think the positivity, the almost universal positivity across society that is created by England's performance in Italia 90, the momentum isn't as much for all of these movements afterwards. So I agree, Jared, that it happens, but it's a lot slower and maybe not as explosive as it does happen afterwards.
I think so, but I think Italia 90 lights the blue touch paper on everything that comes after that. That's my view.
Thanks so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Outside the Box. If you think things might have played out very differently, or especially if you think we nailed it here, we'd love to hear from you.
Or if you have any ideas for other interesting what-ifs, you can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at whatiffootypod, or by email at outsidetheboxwhatif@gmail.com. We hope you tune in again next week. Please tell your friends if you liked the show, and even if you didn't, tell them you did. I've been Dave Fleming.
And I've been Jared O'Shea. And this has been Outside the Box.
Well, it's been a fascinating competition, apart from the final, probably. It's taken a month out of our lives. Actually, it's probably added a month to our lives. We think it's all over, and it is now. Except, of course, for one more time, it's Q Luciano.